Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. On today's show, we're going to talk about the health risks and benefits of farting on planes. And we're going to interview Dr. Danielle Mitchell, an urgent care doctor who's running for Congress in Tennessee. Stay with us.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
Oh, shit.
Who is that?
That's Lizzie. We're keeping that one. And
Joe.
Again, sitting in with us. Thankfully, we have Roger Jagadeesan. Roger, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
How are we doing? Everyone else? That is not Roger.
We're pretty good. I need to tell you guys this just in. I was looking at news earlier and one of our listeners pointed out to me that this is a headline from Saturday that a pilot was forced to make an emergency landing after a row caused by a passenger who refused to stop farting. And I believe row is British for, a fight.
Yeah.
So I don't think the farting is what made the plane land. I think the row did it. But the passenger apparently kept breaking wind on board a Transavia Airlines flight from Dubai to Amsterdam last weekend.
It's not short.
Two Dutchmen sitting next to him didn't take very well to his flatulence, but the unashamed man was apparently not put off and refused to hold back. Is this not an amazing, very appropriate House of Pod topic?
It really, really is.
Straight from the news to the show, just like CIS or something.
I don't know.
CSI.
I don't know. I feel like there's a lot to the story that we don't know.
Kaveh wants more information.
Cause he really
thinks this is appropriate.
Because if the guy was just ripping farts for a whole flight, like that's actually pretty impressive. Like usually you rip a couple and then you're like, you're emptied out, right?
Yeah. I'm actually wondering, were they loud ones or silent and deadly ones?
They must have been silent.
I don't know.
I don't know about that.
I don't know.
If it caused an emergency landing, he was probably doing it over and over and over and he just refused and he was causing so much problems.
I mean, the loud
fights and whatnot. They had to land a plane.
Well, I mean, flights do have a lot of ambient noise going on. So if your fart is going to be loud enough to pick up over that noise, that's a pretty loud one.
That's a fair point.
That's a good point.
And I just don't know how you could have so much gas in your body to create that kind of sound, that kind of velocity coming out of you on a repeat basis. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's questionable.
You guys should just know that all four passengers were detained at some point, but fortunately they've been released because they had not broken any Austrian laws.
Yeah.
Shockingly, farting is not illegal.
Interesting. Fighting could have been.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an unwritten law type thing.
So I have a lot of pulmonary critical care friends, and when they were all fellows years ago, somebody was giving a lecture on sort of equalization of air pressure, and I wasn't there. But, because some people with pulmonary disease need to have oxygen and need to...
Going on a plane changes the pressure, sure.
Right, it can be really dangerous. And then someone in the middle of the lecture, started talking about how you're farting on the plane all the time, and at some point you're really just breathing in 100% fart. Like this happened in a lecture. I don't really know what the outcome of the story was, but I really enjoyed it.
I think we just solved the story. There you go.
Oh my God.
The entire plane was just smelling the
inhaling
fart.
Do you think that affects barotrauma or, your pulmonary function if you're just inhaling farts all the time? I think this is really the fundamental question that we need to answer.
Actually, they should have followed those patients. Like maybe they did better after they inhaled a bunch of farts.
The 10-year perspective study, right. Exactly.
Actually, there was a study like at some point that said breathing in your own farts.
I read something. But it was like one of those Yahoo News.
Okay, hold
headlines.
On a second. We're going to break the fourth wall of the show for a second. We're going to stop the show right here. We're going to go look up that article. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. We did extensive research. And by extensive, I mean that was just like 30 seconds and we pulled it up on our phone. So there was this story that went around the internet a couple months back saying that smelling farts could decrease the risk of cancer, stroke, arthritis, erectile dysfunction, dementia, and other ailments. So I think a lot of people started to think that was kind of bogus. But this all comes from this study that was in the Medicinal Chemistry Communications Journal. And it basically went over hydrogen sulfide and how that can be fatal in large quantities, but it's actually used on a cellular level as well for signaling. And there are some researchers at the University of Exeter that created a molecule that delivered hydrogen sulfide to mitochondria, and they thought it might help the mitochondria, help that cell fight disease. So there's a lot of people made a lot of steps from that to it cures cancer, which it does not. So don't smell farts to cure cancer.
There are actually a lot of steps here from what I'm reading. I mean, whatever. I mean, this compound apparently does bring a tiny amount of hydrogen sulfide into the mitochondria, which is like three steps removed from the fact that whether smelling the farts would actually give you the same right. health benefit of, right. and this is...
It seems totally reasonable. I also have read articles. I've also read articles that are like, you know, if you fart, you can lose weight. The more you fart a day, the happier you are. I've honestly read these things, and it's probably all like women's health magazines and stuff like that. It's not actual like New England Journal of Medicine.
What are
data.
You guys reading for fun?
This is what I read for fun. Yeah.
Listen, a good healthy fart is a good thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyways.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I guess for Joe, because Raja is a doctor and Kaveh is a doctor. Joe, what are your thoughts on hugging doctors?
Wait, in what context are you asking?
Yeah, because I
don't know. I mean, maybe you guys should answer, but you know, I've done
just strangers, patients that you don't know at all, and they just hug you because they.
No, that's hugging strangers on the street.
No,
I mean like a doctor. You know, I've actually, you know, we've done procedures on patients in the office. This, that. And I've definitely have had patients at the end of a visit. Sorry, I should have set it up a little better for Joe. And at the end of a visit, after a procedure, they'll say, oh my God, thank you so much. And people will hug me. Not often, although there was a period where in 1 week I had like 5 hugs, which is, you know, I don't know why I had to count them, but I did. Because that's how clearly it's not the most comfortable thing. Because it is, to me, something I do with people who I'm usually quite close with. But, you know, other people are not like that.
The reason I'm saying that is because my point is that hugging has kind of replaced handshaking lately.
Actually, I feel like it's the opposite now.
Really?
There's the whole Me Too thing and a lot of, like, questions about what's appropriate and not. And I feel like...
Like, even in business, like, a lot of... When we're giving awards to people, we hug now. We don't do the handshake. And so that's why I was asking, is this something that's been constant?
In the business world, huh? Interesting.
No. And everything. Like,
just like everything in medicine for me, I feel like it's all clusters. You know, I've talked about it with Kaveh before, but in a given month, I'll find, like, 3 people who have colon cancer, and I won't have any patients with colon cancer for 6 months. And then it's just this weird thing where you just, as humans, we just notice patterns and clusters, right?
Yeah.
And so, no, I feel like that 1 week there was 5, but generally it's probably 4 times a year where a patient will hug me. And, you know, usually in a appreciation, joy, and it's just, it's something that.
But your question isn't why is it happening more or not.
Right.
Is it appropriate to do?
Yeah. And would that be, you know, as a patient, we're all patients sometimes, like, is that something you would do? Or, and as a doctor for Raja and Kaveh, like, how do you feel? Do you encourage it? Would you sort of back away? That's not appropriate, you know, because sometimes if a patient reaches their hand out to shake your hand, you know, sometimes I'll say, oh, I haven't washed my hands yet. You know, it's an awkward interaction, you know, and do you not encourage that?
I never initiate a hug with a patient, but there's certainly patients that want a hug. My only real hesitation with that is that I'm usually, you know, in my scrubs or in my white coat, and both of those things are things that are exposed to lots of germs in the hospital. I don't want to hug people like who are coming in to visit me in the clinic. So that's usually what I say to them. I say, I'm, you know, you don't want to do that right now. This is my hospital outfit. I don't want to transmitted germs to you. And usually what they say is, I don't care. Yeah. And they still want to come in for the hug. And
they'll be like, I wish you were wearing a tie because those things are filthy. I want to get my face in your tie.
I would assume this is probably happening when something, when you achieve something more than something routine. Like you're not getting it after a colonoscopy, for example, are you?
No.
Like if it's like a cancer and you cured them or made them better, of course a patient, I would be fine with it giving a doctor a hug.
There are some people, though, as we've talked about, who are so nervous about a colonoscopy that when you're done and you say it's normal or I found a polyp, they're ecstatic, you know? And that's just, so yes, 100% after just a routine visit.
Routine, that's different, I think, during a routine visit. And then it goes back to the, you know, when's it appropriate? And then, you know, if I go in for a checkup, am I going to give my doctor a hug and then go to the dentist for a cleaning and give them, you know, it's just, it can be overly done. Mm-hmm. But I think if it's for some sort of achievement you accomplished, they're just showing recognition. Great. That's an interesting question because there's a fine line.
It seems like, that situation, it might be routine for you, but it was not routine for them. I mean, for them, that's something like they've been dreading this for years and they've been putting off the colonoscopy because they don't want to do this.
Right.
And they're worried about how bad it's going to
be. So relieved that it's normal and they got through it, you know? Yeah. I mean, again, the circumstance is sort of, not really the point. It's just the concept of hugging because it also made me think about, because Kaveh and I talked about this recently, is as a doctor crying in front of patients, you know, and I feel like they're not the same, but those are to me kind of fall in line and one makes me think about the other because Kaveh had an experience a few weeks ago where he cried.
Which I guess I'm going to talk about now.
Oh, sorry.
It's all right. I had a patient who I was very close to. I liked this guy a lot, followed him for a while, and he was he was a very warm character, and he was ill, and he did pass away, and I had a conversation with his wife afterwards, and she started crying during it, and it was hard for me. I it's tough. It's a fine line. Like, you don't want to be a robot. You don't want to live that way. You want to have connections to your patients. But at the same time, you can't cry every time a patient has a bad outcome or bad things happen to them just because that's just weighs on you too much. And that particular case, I did. I cried along with her. And it worried me at first.
This was in person or
on the
phone?
No, this is over the phone. Mm-hmm. And it worried me at first because I thought, am I making the situation worse for her? Am I feeding into her trauma, or am I making her situation worse? I don't think it was. And that's what I'm walking away with at the end of that, was that I think it meant something to her too, to realize that her husband had touched me in that way. And that it wasn't just a routine patient doctor business interaction. It was something deeper than that. And it did affect me. And I think she liked that. I think there are some doctors who will be with patients and the patients will say, will you pray with us, doctor? And those doctors will do it. That's not my thing, but I'm not afraid at the same time to show emotion, I think, in front of my patients. I did question whether that was appropriate or not for me to do. That did cross my mind.
I mean, the great thing about it is that it's not something you thought about. You know, you're not like, I'm going to cry to make her happy. I'm going to cry to empathize. I'm going to cry to make me feel better. You know, it happened. It's like a genuine moment.
But that's the thing, though. I mean, that's what worried me, too, is I'm like, I was saying I'm in a very sort of selfish way. I was afraid that I was bringing this back to me. Whereas it should have been about her. And
right.
Her,
you felt like you should support her and not need her support.
Exactly.
Right. So when you cry, that's what people do.
Right. And that was part of it. I didn't want it to be like, okay, now feel bad for me. I'm the doctor. Feel bad for me. That was part of my fear too. I didn't want that to happen.
I think it's so. It does. It happens to me, I think. Usually when other people cry, it sort of triggers me a little bit. And again, probably a couple times a year, but it's not that common. I don't, for any of us, I don't think to do it. Raja, do you have a crying story?
Oh no, it's interesting to me that was your reaction. Cause I'm first of all, I think it's impressive and I think it speaks to kind of the relationship that you had with this patient and his family that you felt that way. And I don't think that would have occurred to me that it would have made it worse. In my experience, I think sharing that kind of emotion, especially in times of loss, if anything, I think makes everybody have a more cathartic moment. I mean, I actually think it helps, if anything.
I totally
I mean, it's just kind of a corroboration and the catharsis of kind of like, this really is a loss. And I think it's actually, it helps people go through the moment and you have to feel it. I mean, I think one of the mistakes that a lot of people make in the grieving process, and I say this as a person who's, you know, we have a lot of kind of end of life discussions in my profession and we have a lot of kind of family meetings about this kind of stuff. People have to feel it. And the worst thing people do is actually when they try and be stoic and they try not to feel it. Because the truth is, you're going to feel it in some level anyways. It's better to actually acknowledge it openly and work through it rather than walk around with it for days or months or whatever, whatever. And if anything, I think sharing that emotion may have been very helpful, I think.
Yeah. I think in the end it was. I think that is what happened in this particular case. I think it was sort of helpful for this person to see that her loved one was someone who touched other people's lives, even people who didn't know him as well as she did.
And it's helpful for her, like you're saying, but also what Raj is saying, like, so you're not carrying around like that sadness and, you know, that we talk a lot about physician burnout. Like if you don't get to express it to this woman who knows what you're feeling the best and obviously more intensely, then I do think it's like a wonderful moment to like release that and not carry it around with you because, you know, I do think it contributes to empathy burnout, physician burnout, stress, all those things. So. Yeah. I don't know. I don't think it's inappropriate. I think if you're doing it every time all the day, you know, you know, I found a polyp. So
right.
That's, you know, that's not appropriate. But I think that I know we all know so many doctors and everyone has one or two of these stories a year. And I think it's probably meaningful, you know, and a good thing to have in your pocket somehow.
Yeah. I mean, as a patient, it can really come off bad if a robot or if a doctor comes off like a robot during a serious situation. It can almost be offensive. So as long as, it can't be every day you're crying with everybody, but I think if it's genuine, don't hold it back. It usually helps.
The worst thing would be is if you're like a sobber, like a really bad, like, first of all, I'm an ugly crier, ugly. Like my sister and I, we joke about it all the time, get red, blotchy, like my eyes swell out, snot, you know, all this stuff. So that ugly crier is one thing, but like, if you're like sobbing and you can't talk about the disease or the patient, like you need to actually be able to communicate and cry. That would be the ideal.
Right. You know? That's a good point, actually.
But you need to get,
you don't want a panicky doctor. That's the worst thing.
Yeah. Anyway, I recommend try to avoid
like
ugly crying.
Someone's being wheeled in for a colonoscopy and Lizzie's just like, they're like, do we need to reschedule? No, I'm okay.
It takes you 20 minutes to consent a patient because you're like hiccuping and really, snortling.
I can really come back. It's not a big deal. No, you're already.
I'm glad we took that sad topic and turned it upside down into a smile.
Coming up next, we'll be talking to Danielle Mitchell, doctor and hopefully the next congresswoman of the 3rd District of Tennessee.
So thank you so much for coming, Dr. Danielle Mitchell, running for office in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
In the 3rd District of Tennessee, correct?
Yeah, the U.S. Congressional District, 3rd District.
And you are a primary care sports medicine doctor. Can you share a little bit of that with us? Can you tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you ended up in Tennessee?
Being a doctor and a politician, a very rare combination.
No, I would have never thought that I was going to med school to go into politics, but here we are. So originally from the West Coast, from Oregon, and I like to tell people as I'm talking to them on the campaign trail that, you know, this connection that we all have, especially in a state where, you know, we're at here in Tennessee, where we're really struggling a lot with a lot of different things. And health is one of the things I think that our state struggles with the most. And, you know, I tell them that I come from, my roots are in struggle and my family, you know, it's easy to say these days, you know, like, oh, I grew up poor and, you know, I walked to school both uphill and, you know, on the way there and uphill on the way back. But when I talk about growing up, I mean, I really did grow up poor and I came from a family of 6, 4 kids. Mom drove a school bus and dad was in construction. And, you know, my dad's job was seasonal at best. So that introduced a lot of instability in terms of our financial security. and grew up uninsured as well. So oftentimes, you know, like I can recount by the time I was in sixth grade, I had attended six different elementary schools because the fact of the matter is my family was getting evicted from house after house. And we were either, you know, getting evicted or we're moving for work. So, you know, growing up in that element of instability, I think made a very early impression on me. And one of my younger brothers also struggled with a chronic disease, epilepsy. And I can remember my parents actually having to borrow money at times. And this is, you know, understand, this is like 25 years ago. Even then, having to borrow money to cover the cost of medicine. And one of the bills eventually that my family couldn't pay was the bill to see the doctor. And it was shortly before, it was about a week actually before my brother's 13th birthday, that he had a massive seizure and died in our home.
Oh.
Then you take out a loan and then you're faced with like astronomical interest rates, probably in addition to not having health care. And that's an awful state. Yeah.
Right. And in a state like Tennessee, what a lot of people don't know about Tennessee is number one in the nation for filings of bankruptcy. And it's because of health care.
Wow. Is that where the spark to become a doctor first started for you? Or is that something that happened later?
Yeah. So, you know, my connections actually to healthcare, I think really were influenced by the way I grew up, Kaveh. And you know, I had nobody in my family, my immediate family had gone to school, but my cousin, who I'm very close with, she did. And I remember watching her from a distance. You know, you kind of see things in terms of like cards, and, you know, she would show up every now and then for a family gathering because she was going to school outside of where we lived. Mm-hmm. And I just remember like thinking as a kid, I was like, that's the exit from all of this mm-hmm. instability. Mm-hmm. I have to go to school. And a lot of people, you know, when they grow up, they have, you know, these people that they look towards. My cousin was certainly one of those for me. But you also, I think a lot of people presuppose that you have the support of your parents to do that. And for a period of time growing up, I didn't. And I'm not talking about financial support. I'm talking about emotional support. My parents really were not supportive of me going to college. And I remember when I was trying to fill out my applications for school that my parents hadn't filled out any of their tax information for years. And, you know, for whatever their reason was at that time, they didn't understand until I started bringing it to their attention that I couldn't get financial aid in school if I didn't have my parents' financial tax data. And in bringing this up, a lot of times I was met with the statement, you know, I don't need to worry about it because I'm not going to go to college.
Yeah.
And that, I think that just, you know, part of my personality and who I am, it just made me dig my heels in even deeper. And much to my parents' credit, they did come back finally and filled out their tax information, and I was able to get financial aid. But it was, you know, it's a pretty big endeavor being a first time person, you know, a person from your family who's going to college.
It's a big deal. I mean, not just that, but then to go on to be a doctor. Lizzie and I talk a lot about how, and Raja too, we talk a lot about how our families and having family members who are doctors, how much that helps in terms of making our decision, forming our decision to go into medicine. We have a ton of respect for people who don't have that background and they still see it and they figure out what they want to do when they're able to do it, especially in a situation like yours where things were not laid out for you to do so.
Right. It's not even support necessarily, I think, in your family or someone pushing you or encouraging or discouraging. It's just seeing someone in your family, like you said, your cousin at least, go to college. Like we all have family members who are doctors, it just immediately becomes accessible. Education, a career, you know, there's some ambition. You know, you have to sort of see it to or be exposed to it to want it, you know?
Right, exactly. And I think in my particular case, I was being exposed to all these things that were like, whoa, this is not cool. Right. Like I do not like, you know, experiencing the hurt and the instability. And I really wanted to do better, you know, for not only myself, but for the people around me. And, you know, so I graduated and I did my best in high school. I think actually the year I graduated, I think there was like 7 or 8 valedictorians and I was one of them, and then finished with only like, I think I finished with a 4.0, and then I only received like $1,000 in scholarships because that's all that was available. Oh, wow.
So, can you tell us, you were very public, I guess, on your websites and in articles about your struggle with obesity, with morbid obesity. Yeah. And we've talked, it comes up a lot on our show. You know, we talked about fatty liver and how a patient was offended when they were told that they had fatty liver, or that was a question we had, and the kind of advice that you give. And we deal with that every day in GI because we're liver and GI doctors, but also just taking care of patients and encouraging them to eat differently. And we've talked a lot about, you can't just tell someone to lose weight. You know, you have to sort of, it's lifestyle coaching and like you're talking about education and support. So you can tell us a little bit about your experience and also what you would recommend for doctors to give advice to their patients and also patients who are listening as well, who are struggling with this.
Yeah. So 2007 was the year that was like kind of my big life changing year. And I was pushing about 250 pounds on a 5'6" frame. And I had my first actual experience in residency was I was training in surgery. I was training to be a hand and facial reconstructive surgeon. And, you know, I joke with people that being a doctor is really unhealthy. And I had never experienced that more so than I had as a surgical resident. And my life just really was, you know, I was really pushing a lot of weight. I was starting to experience the negative side effects from having a lot of weight, you know, joint aches. I was marathoning my first marathon. I was like 202 pounds, I think. And then my second marathon a year later, I was 206 pounds because I'd been taught through this, you know, cultural experience that like, oh, you're carrying extra weight because you're not exercising enough. And well, if I just start marathoning, it's going to come off. Well, guess what? It didn't come off. Wow. It was like, you know, the next year I was even heavier for my marathon. And what I figured out in the process of all that was, and I tell my patients this, that, you know, fitness is really actually, it's a like picture a fork in your mind, and fitness is 80% nutrition, 20% exercise. You can't outrun a fork. Mm-hmm. And so it was back in 2007 that I decided I was going to join Weight Watchers, which was my first real exposure into mastering nutrition. And, you know, Weight Watchers was great. I mean, I lost about 30 pounds and was really starting to develop, I think, not just this relationship with food, but how I was like interacting with myself. And, a lot of times food is this thing. It's so cultural. We celebrate with food, you know, whether it's happiness or sad. And we not only celebrate with others in food, we celebrate with ourselves with food, or we placate. And then food also happens to be this thing that's crucial for survival. So, you know, you're not getting away from it one way or the other. And there's this other new parallel that I started to understand, which is that food in particular, processed foods, really are laden with substances that promote addiction. Mm-hmm. And they promote these unhealthy behaviors that bring people back. And then that's the nidus of disease right there for a lot of people is overconsumption of processed foods. And so, you know, I had joined Weight Watchers, dropped about 30 pounds, and it had always been a lifelong goal of mine to say, like, I'm going to do an Ironman. And I just remember watching like my first Ironman on TV. And I was like, these two women, this is like a famous scene where these two women are coming into the finish line and they're so just emaciated from the struggle of what that race is all about, that the first woman who's about to win falls. She collapses like right before the finish line. And it's this agonizing, like, oh my God, like, get up, you know, crawl if you have to. So she starts to crawl. And then this other woman comes in and she trips over the first woman and then she can't get up either. So they're flopping around on the ground, crawling. And finally one of them like gets up and like, you know, crosses the finish line. And I watched that and I was like, I'm going to do that.
One. That made you, that made you want to do it.
I had the exact opposite reaction to that.
Me too.
I'm like, oh dude, I'm going to sit down and just take a break. I'm exhausted. Like,
yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was just like, it was just that epitome of like, whoa, those people went out and swam almost 2.5 miles and they biked 112 and then ran a marathon. And I just thought like, that's what I want to do. So, I set my sights on it, and it was actually in my second year of residency that, actually my first year is when I started training for triathlon. And then it was my second year that I committed to training for a full. And, on the full Ironman that first time around, you know, I trained for almost a year and, gradually built up, you know, my cardiovascular endurance and in the process of that lost almost 100 pounds. And it really just ignited like this understanding or this desire to gain more understanding about not only how the body responds in a physical manner, but also, you know, nutrition was a huge part of my paradigm. And it changed the scope of my career at that point, because then people, you know, they kind of saw me as like the results, not typical person, but they really are typical if you have a roadmap and you have a really good cheerleader. So I became a cheerleader for a lot of people, and I even do it now in my practice, even campaigning full time. I still practice 2 days a week. And what I'm really famous for in my practice is, if you asked me when I was a med student, you know, like what's the power in being a physician? And then I would have said like, well, you know, it's the knowledge, because you need to know how to cure people. And, you know, there's this thing called the prescription pad and that's important. And then, you know, you need to be able to interface with people. And now, you know, I graduated med school in 2006 and I've been in medicine now for actually over 20 years from when I first started in it. And if you were to ask me now, like, what's the power of being a physician or a healthcare provider, I'd tell you the knowledge is important. There's no doubt about it. You need to be able to diagnose what's looking at you. And that prescription pad, okay, it's got its time and place, you know, in some areas. But ultimately, the real power in curing people and helping them is to inspire them.
Okay, so the interview with Daniel Mitchell keeps going because there's so much information that she goes over that's important. We want to discuss. There's so much valuable info in there that we actually split this into 2 episodes. So stay tuned for the next episode release for the conclusion of our interview with Daniel Mitchell. Thank you so much, Daniel Mitchell, for coming on the show today. And for everyone out there listening, remember to check us out on Facebook, like us, follow us on iTunes. Please rate us. It really helps get more listeners to the show if you do that. We're also on Stitcher as well. Take care.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.